I was asking Melody and Eve where this title came from, because the idea that I could display wisdom in action is one which would have my wife falling all over the place in laughter. But subtitle is Facing Ethical Challenges in Research. I'm not going to talk about how you get your project past NREC. There are wonderful websites that you can go on to find out how to submit your proposals to get ethical approval. And I'm not going to talk about the sort of highfalutin ethical dilemmas of embryo research or stem cell research. I'm going to talk about the kind of ethical issues that each one of us face if we're doing any sort of research at all. I've always felt, and I banged on at the Institute of Medical Ethics, about the idea that when we talk about medical ethics, we always focus on the real big issue problems, and those aren't day-to-day what actually bother us. It's the little things. So let's see how we go. I thought I'd start off with just thinking about how it is that we develop any sort of ethical principles at all. And I'm in despair that we have a proper ethicist with us today. So close your ears. Close your ears. But all of our ethical principles fundamentally start with our worldview. Again, one of the problems with modern medical ethics is that it is based on a naturalistic worldview. But as Christians, we've got to fit in with God's worldview and with the Christian worldview. There is also an input from ethical philosophy is a major academic discipline. There are all sorts of theories the consequentialism, utilitarianism, virtue ethics, which I feel much more comfortable with, that is the idea that it's not all down to some sort of formula, it's down to whether or not you're a good person. But even then, virtue ethics is difficult, because how do you then work out what it is that a good person would do? Societal norms have a huge input into what is acceptable as ethical principles. You may say ethical principles shouldn't change, but there is drift. What would have been unthinkable 50 years ago is now being put forward as being what society wants. And when you put all of those things together, you end up with a series of general ethical principles which are nothing to do specifically with research or medicine. They are to do with how we interact with one another in life. From those general ethical principles, we derive specific ethical principles that apply to research ethics or medical clinical ethics. And from those specific principles, we've developed codes and laws, and we develop working rules, which are actually day by day what we use. So in reality, it is rare for us to go back to first principles in ethics. We tend to work from the working rules that people have accepted. The whole thing is in a constant state of flux. It is a constantly changing field, and it even impacts on our worldview. And if we're not careful as Christians, we can begin to accept the worldview of people around us and think that that is where the truth lies. Okay, so what are the general ethical principles as we derive them from our Christian worldview? And the first I would say is respect for persons. That is fundamental to the way we live our lives. And the basis for that in our worldview is that humans are made in the image of God. All humans are made in the image of God. Now, the theologians have been arguing for 2,000 years or more as to what that means. But whoever the human being is, they are made in the image of God, and that has to affect our respect for them. Honesty is a fundamental ethical principle, because God is the God of truth. And if we are going to live as his children, we have to live with truth. And justice, as we've already seen this morning, God is the God of justice. and justice becomes a fundamental ethical principle. If you have been through the usual medical ethics courses in our medical schools in this country, you will see that these general ethical principles don't match with Beauchamp and Childers' general ethical principles, because I'm not quite sure where they derive theirs from, but these are the ones that I think have got a theological underpinning. Their principles of non-maleficence and beneficence, of course, are incorporated into respect for persons. If you've got respect for a person, then you're not going to harm them. And if you've got respect for a person, then you're going to do the best for them. The one that really bugs me with their principles is the principle of autonomy. And of course, autonomy has become the driving principle that it governs everything we do these days. Everybody is supposed to have a free choice in everything. Now, first of all, from the Christian point of view, we are not autonomous beings. We are created beings dependent entirely on God for our very existence. Every breath we take is dependent on God. So to say, I am autonomous, I can do what I want, I am in command of the situation, is complete nonsense. And even on an interpersonal level, between individuals, the idea that the patient has absolute autonomy and therefore can demand whatever treatment they feel they want conflicts with my autonomy as a practitioner. And in every human interaction, there is always two autonomies conflicting with one another. And life is not about autonomy. Life is about interaction and interrelationship. So respect for persons, I think, is a much more fundamental and useful concept than the idea of autonomy. End of sermon. Okay, if we apply those specific principles into the research field, what does respect for persons look like? And it's, of course, the idea of informed consent. Confidentiality, duty of care. Maybe others, but these are the main ones that I think seem to arise from respect for persons. It is now universally accepted that before you enter a patient into a research program, they should give their informed consent. But that actually is very difficult, because what about patients with dementia or other reasons for loss of ability to take decisions? Does that mean we cannot do any research on those patients? But we may have some form of treatment that would benefit them. How do we get informed consent for patients who are not able to give that consent? Okay, we'll get, according to the Declaration of Helsinki, we're allowed to get somebody else to give consent for them. But actually, legally, in this country, I don't know about other countries, but in this country, you can't give consent for anybody else, unless there is already a health power of attorney in place. So the doctor has to act in the best interest of the person. And as surgeons, we've all filled in forms, the best interest of the person form, where you say, in your opinion as a senior surgeon, this operation is in the best interest of the patient, although they're not able to give consent for it. There's a conflict of interest when it comes to research, because it's easy for me as a surgeon to say it is best for this patient to have the operation, but if it's a question of putting the patient into my trial, then who's going to take that? So there is a problem there. Confidentiality, again, nobody would argue with that, but it can cause problems if you are doing a long-term follow-up study. We will anonymize all the data in the database. Well, that's great until you want to look 5 years' time and you want to contact the patients to follow them up and see what's happened. How do you do it if everything is anonymized? And duty of care, again, it's a fundamental duty that we have as doctors. the first duty of the patient, according to good medical practice, is the care of the patient. In the research terms, we've got that duty of care to look after the patient during the research process so that we're not doing anything that harms the patient. But what about after the treatment has stopped? We still have that duty of care after the trial has stopped to go on offering that patient treatment. And this, of course, has been one of the problems with pharmaceutical research programs in the developing world, where while they've been on the program, they've got the treatment, but when the program comes to an end and the researchers have got the results they need, the treatment has ceased. So what about the specific principle of honesty? Candor, again, we have a duty of candor. The GMC says so. This is particularly with respect to things going wrong in medical treatment, but it also applies to any research program that you're going to undertake. Now, again, at first sight, that seems straightforward. Where would the issue be? Back in the early 1980s, back in the dark ages, when people still thought that mastectomy was the only viable treatment for breast cancer, the CRC set up a study comparing breast conservation with mastectomy. Duty of candor, we said to all the patients, there is a trial going on. We don't know which treatment's best. There is a trial going on. Will you enter the trial? 10% of patients agreed to enter the trial, 25% opted for mastectomy, and 65% opted for breast conservation. So suddenly, all our calculations about the number of patients we needed to, or the length of time it would take to complete the study, were shot to pieces because only 10% were entering the trial. The other question that then arose was, is there something different about the 10% who are prepared to enter the trial compared to the others? And I can go on forever and ever about the ramifications of unwinding all that. Some people said, okay, well, the only way around that is to randomize the people before you tell them that there is a study. So instead of saying, this is the study, would you mind being randomized? You randomize them and then go to them saying, we're doing a study and you have been drawn to this treatment. But is that candor? Are you being open with the patient? Intellectual rigor? Does that come under honesty? I think it does. It is actually applying the full force of your critical thinking to what you're doing, to your research program. And we might talk about that a bit more. Self-transparency. All of us have biases. And that bias very often can affect the outcome of our results. Less so perhaps in the laboratory, but not entirely absent from the laboratory, because if you get a bunch of results that don't fit with what you expected, you could accept them, or you could look to see what it was that went wrong that made them not come out the way you expected. But particularly self-transparency is important in qualitative research, where actually your biases can influence the answers you're getting from the patient. And in fact, if I'm refereeing a qualitative paper, which I do a lot, I look to see have the authors actually addressed this issue of self-transparency and what my biases were and how that might have affected the outcome. And what about justice? It's quite clear, again, in the Declaration of Helsinki, that research that's undertaken should only be undertaken if it has potential benefits for the patient group. So patients, again, Paul talked about not looking at your colleagues as means to an end when you network, but equally, you should not look at your patients as means to an end when you're doing your research. Slightly different issue with volunteers, and volunteers are an ethical challenge. if there is no potential benefit to the individual that you're researching on, then your bar for avoiding harm to the patient is that much higher. So we need to be careful about that. Fair access, and this really applies again at the end of your study, when you find that a particular treatment is effective, will the group of people you have done the research on actually benefit and have fair access to that treatment? And the ultimate example of that was the retroviral trials that took place in Africa, where there was no way that the people who were the subjects of the trial would ever have access to the treatment once the trial had stopped. Okay, so those are the sort of specific principles relating to medical research. They've been codified, and the first code was in the Nuremberg Code, and the Nuremberg Code arose from the war crime trials in Nuremberg in 1947. It was actually written by the judges. There was no medical input into it at all. But it did enshrine the kind of principles that we now regard as important, like consent being necessary for treatment, being necessary for research to undertake. It was ignored by the medical profession for nearly 20 years. And it wasn't until 1964 that the World Medical Association published the Declaration of Helsinki. And the Declaration of Helsinki, everywhere except the USA, is now regarded as the fundamental background to the codes of research ethics. It's been revised 7 times. The latest revision was 2013. In addition to those codes which set out the sort of principles that we should be following, there are working rules. The MRC publishes a set of guidelines, good research practice, and if you want an MRC grant, you have got to adhere to those codes of practice. You will probably be familiar with good clinical practice. Anybody who's running a clinical trial has got to actually do a course on good clinical practice and has to adhere to the principles of good clinical practice. And the Council for International Organizations of Medical Sciences has produced its own set of guidelines. Very similar to the MRC guidelines, but they apply if you're working internationally rather than with the MRC. So that's the sort of background to the principles and where we find them. What are the practical implications? First of all, we need to look at our motivation. Why are we undertaking this particular research project? There are good reasons: to advance basic knowledge, to improve treatment outcomes, to improve the patient experience. There are less good ones, which Paul's already alluded to improve your CV, to score well in the ref, because the boss says you've got to do it. The principle of double effect applies. You may do all those nice good things on the left-hand side of the slide, and the other effects will come along with it. So it's not bad to improve your CV, but that should not be the motivation. And there's a question about the utility of the research project, the famous so what question. If this is true, so what? And the question there is the research question important? Now, importance has nothing to do with the size of grant that you can get with it. There are two research projects which I think are among the most useful I know of. One was done by an orthopaedic registrar while I was a surgical registrar, and Bill Grange looked at the question of how you treat fractured collarbones. In those days, we put a figure of eight bandage on. You strap the patient back. He compared doing that with putting the patient into a simple collar and cuff sling. How many of you have seen a figure of eight bandage? okay? He completely changed the way people dealt with fractured clavicles. And the other one is a paper which one of my colleagues at UEA published, one of the primary care professors, on the treatment of earwax. Again, it is not, you would regard, a major health problem. It actually used up an awful lot of GP and nurse time in dealing with it. And his sort of review of the subject and his publication of the subject altered the way people thought about treating earwax. So it's not to do with the size of budget or the severity of the problem. It's to do with, is it going to make a useful contribution? If you go in complete contrast, Big Pharma will do multi-center trials to compare their beta blocker, which they have just developed, with the standard beta blocker. You know, it's a lot of money, it's a lot of resource. Read Ben Goldacre and Bad Pharma on the whole science, whole subject of unimportant research being done. Once you've decided the question's important, the next question is what's already known about the subject. And I see an awful lot of proposals for research, and I think to myself, but we already have a lot of evidence on that. And the question then is, what will this study add? So if you are thinking of carrying out research, do please do a systematic review of the literature and find out what you actually need to do. What's the question that you need to do, that you need to add to the already existing knowledge? The concept of equipoise is important, particularly if you're setting up a clinical trial. You should only set up a clinical trial if, in your view, the evidence is equally balanced as to whether the treatment works or not. Okay? If there is good evidence in the literature that the treatment works, it is unethical to establish a clinical trial. But if having looked at all the evidence, you still cannot give a clear answer, then you go ahead. What about study design? The question there is this the best way to answer the question that you've asked? Methodology valid and reliable? Again, one of the things that I see quite often is people looking at patient-related or patient-reported outcomes. And patient-reported outcomes, they're the flavour of the month, certainly in surgery. And people design their questionnaire. They produce a questionnaire and say, I am going to look at the patient outcomes using this questionnaire. It takes 3 years to develop a proper questionnaire. Developing a questionnaire is a major research project in its own right. So you can't just sit down over coffee with the people in the department and write a questionnaire and say, here we go, okay? The other thing about the methodology being valid and reliable is, are you actually capable of delivering it? I had a wonderful sort of ongoing row in Liverpool when we had a new head of department. And I did a lot of research on the molecular biology of breast cancer in tandem with the professor of molecular biology in the university. And my colleague came along and said, it would be much better for the profile of the department and for the research assessment exercises it then was, if we brought all that work in-house. So why don't we do the molecular biology? Well, if you've got one of the world's leading authorities on molecular biology and he is keen to work with you, why would you do it yourself? So another important question is the planned sample size adequate? Again, research proposals say things like, we are planning to study 100 patients. And you say, why 100? Well, that's what we think we will be able to accumulate in the time frame of the study. Well, I've done a quick calculation, and you actually need 200 patients before you're going to get any meaningful results. It is unethical to move ahead with a study if your planned sample size is not adequate to give you an answer. And is the control group relevant? Again, going back many years ago, we were interested in patients with mastalgia. It's a major problem. Not life-threatening, but it does affect quality of life. The feeling at the time, it was written in all the papers, was that women with mastalgia were mad. Well, they were neurotic, was what it said. Study to compare them. The control group that was used were women who were coming in for treatment for varicose veins. Those of you who have qualified recently won't realize that in the old days, half of the surgical list used to be doing varicose veins for people for purely cosmetic reasons. They're not exactly the best group to make comparisons with if you're trying to work out whether women have got psychological problems, because they themselves possibly had psychological problems. So that was an inappropriate control group. We ended up using as the control group women who were reassured. They came with the clinic with breast pain, and we reassured them there was nothing wrong and they didn't need any treatment. And we compared those with the women who, despite being reassured, continued to want treatment. And blow me down, there is a difference, but it's to do with their anxiety levels. So you need an appropriate control group. How do we deal with all this ethically? Ask a statistician before you actually set the study up. My professor of medical statistics used to tear his hair out because people would come along to him at the end of the study with all this data and say, could you analyze that for me? And he'd say, no, because your study design is useless. Go to them at the beginning and get the study design right. And it is unethical to run a study that is not properly designed and won't answer the question. The subjects, they need to be voluntary. Already talked about informed consent, but just what constitutes informed consent. There must be no coercion, and that could be in any sort of way, offering rewards for entering the trial. You'll actually get seen if you enter the trial. You might get a hospital bed. My son, who is a hospital manager, sent me a cartoon which shows the consultant at the bedside of the patient saying, you have a very rare condition, a bed in the hospital. And ideally, the subject should not be in a dependent relationship. So you should not actually be, as the research PI, treating your own or researching on your own patients. You should be getting somebody else to actually recruit them for the study. Okay? Implementation, sticking to the protocol. I know that sounds daft, but it's very easy if you're running a trial to look at a patient and think, I don't think they'll do very well, I won't enter them into the study. And it may be one of the reasons why it is very difficult in ordinary clinical practice to replicate the results that you get in studies. Because in ordinary clinical practice, you're treating everybody, not the ones that you are unconsciously selecting out. So when you've got your criteria for selection, stick to your criteria for selection. Accurate recording of the results. This harks back to what I said before about the results that come in that don't fit with your preconceptions, and we won't put that one in. It happens. So you should have somebody independently to say that things are running well, and particularly in clinical trials where you're trying a new treatment, somebody who's looking to see that there is not some sort of excess mortality in one of the arms of the trial. Anything less than this is unethical. Publication is an ethical imperative. Yeah, it's good for your career, but if you have put patients through research, it is unethical not to publish the results, even if the results are negative. Now, you may have difficulty getting the negative results published, but you should still make every effort because that negative result is important. You all know about publication bias in systematic reviews. The trials that are actually published are the more likely to be the ones that show a significant effect. Publication maximizes the benefit not only for your patients but for everybody else. It justifies the use of resources that you've made. If you've expended a lot of time and effort and money and patience in doing a research project, it's only justified if that becomes common knowledge to everybody else. And it shows respect to the subjects who've agreed to enter your research program. There are temptations with publication, falsification, and fabrication. 20 years ago, I would have been horrified at the idea that there was extensive falsification and fabrication in medical research. I'm afraid the truth is that there is. Dr. Fuji, who is a Japanese anaesthetist, had to retract 183 papers because he had falsified the data. There was a gynecologist, about 20 years ago, he completely fabricated the data. The patients that he reported on didn't exist at all. He just made them up and then had the paper published in The Lancet. He was caught, so don't do it. And that raises the question of honorary authorship. The idea that you tag on, I'll put your name on my paper if you put my name on your paper, and therefore we'll double our output. The gynecologist who fabricated professor was second author on the paper. He didn't read it. He didn't check the data. He got done by the GMC for serious professional misconduct. And you should only be an author if you've actually contributed to the work. The title was Wisdom in Action. There are all sorts of pitfalls. We've just sort of skated over things and given random examples. God does promise, if any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it'll be given to you. If you're not sure if you're doing something in your research, pray about it. God will answer that as well as anything else. Thank you.